Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Welcome to the show, Ambrose, who is a
designer
paleontologist,
anthropologist. Oh my god,
designer anthropologist. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I'll just say it's designer anthropologist, founder of Pure Fantastico.
Okay, perfect. And out of all the filmmakers we decided to tackle, it's like ones that apply the most to this role for his psychological profiles.
Yep.
It's none other than Stanley Kubrick. And
the man, the myth, the legend.
Yeah. I'll start you off here before we kind of list our favorite movies that kind of are good examples of this real life concept. What was your introduction to him?
I actually saw A Clockwork Orange way too young in the worst time of my life.
Oh, dear.
And it was like, oh, I hate him. Oh, God, I hate him. I hate what he's doing. You know, like a 14-year-old girl is not going to understand what that is about. So that was my first introduction. But what got me to really connect with him and why we're on this podcast together was 2001 Space Odyssey.
Very good point. That was the first one I ever saw. It was basically the only one I could watch that was rated anywhere near PG.
Yeah. Well, I saw it with a friend being like, oh, I think I've seen posters of this movie in Spencer's. I could watch. But 2001 Space Odyssey, I saw at 24, which is like way more age appropriate. And
I think I was 13, maybe 14, but I see what you mean. It's definitely one of those where it was funny. I was a completist of anything that was a visual effects epic, because I just would always read about it in the film history books. It's like, okay, here I'm talking about this. I remember seeing it with my grandparents. They didn't know what it was or what it meant. And they just shrugged their shoulders saying, interesting. And I went home, told my father, you know, I was like, oh, what movie did you see with the grandparents? Oh, you saw that? Yeah, at the very end. It's very mind-blowing because it shows how the man's entire life has evolved right in front of him. It's so wild how he explained what happened in 3 hours. I didn't know what was going on, but yeah, no, that's a good point. Is like you look at all the best movie lists and you seriously have to do some serious research on them to brace yourself, make time for them, because if you don't, then you, like you say, you only lead yourself to disappointment. And let's say even if you don't care for it, you're going to be way more disappointed not knowing what the hell to expect versus...
Well, you feel like you wasted your time.
Time, and then you feel like an outsider is like, I'm going to say something that's going to piss a bunch of people off because I don't get it. And I'm more angry because I feel like I'm missing something. But really, I feel like everyone else is brainwashed, when really it could be just the other way around. I'm an idiot and I don't get it, you know? And so, like you say, I think Kubrick, he excels at the unpredictable, and at the same time, he's dangerous. You don't know what you're going to get, regardless of what movie you're getting into. Like Past the Glory, I saw with a bunch of college students, you know, at in one of those film, you know, meetings that was assigned. I didn't know what I was getting myself into, even with a speaker telling us about the movie beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Way by it. And like you say, Clockwork's another example. The last time I saw 2001, second viewing, and it was so funny. It was a film studies class, and, you know, we're all, you know, exhausted at the end of the day. It's 3-hour class, and it's just so funny. Half the class really fucking hated the movie. We can curse on this program, by the way. And the second portion really enjoyed it, really dug it. And there was maybe 3 or 5 people who were like, oh, I should have been high when I'm watching this. So it was so – that stuck with me, because the film studies class in general was pretty lame. The professor wasn't very good at actually doing their job, and she and the other guy is just basically always just argued about what was considered classic and what wasn't, as opposed to actually, you know, kind of doing what Turner Classic Movies does and give us some insight into the whole thing. Mm-hmm. and then maybe kind of make it film history and open up a discussion. And so it was bad because everyone else was lazy. I was like one of 3 people who asked questions, and I'm like, I'm seriously sick of asking questions.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. At some point you're like, let's just have a conversation, me and you, and these other people fade away in the background.
Exactly. And so, yeah, with that one, it was interesting because everybody had a mixed bag on it, and other people were like, I like the last 20 minutes, or, you know, I like the Hall 9000 segment. I don't like the other stuff, you know.
Thing with Kubrick's films, 2001 specifically, it's difficult when you begin to feel like, oh, I can take pieces out and still maintain what this movie is. And I think that's the trap. That is emphatically the trap of watching a Kubrick film.
It's because definitely a trap. And
if you think about like Full Metal Jacket, right? Like
I was gonna go there, as well as Eyes Wide Shut. Like those, like you say, both movies are basically, you know, people, like you say, get into arguments. I like the first half, or like the second half.
But and they're, like they're two halves of the same thing. You can't right. take one without the other. And as much as Kubrick loves the, let's say, the shocking, the jarring, the unexpected, he relishes in the banal and in the mundane.
Exactly.
And so he lulls the viewer into like, oh, I can just relax, because hell no, you cannot relax. You must be even more vigilant because you think you can relax.
Oh, there's that. And like you say, if you were to dare to do a fan edit of a movie, again, it wouldn't make sense one way without the other, because like you say, you're getting, it's not only apples and oranges, it's also one part of the same quarter, you know.
Yep. Well, and I think
heads or tails,
what I love when watching, I mean, film just in general, but I can trust that with a Kubrick film, there is an intention. And so even if like I don't understand it, or I can't connect to the why, that doesn't mean I have the arrogance to be like, that doesn't belong there. And that's with a Kubrick film. I mean, that's just a Lynch film, but that is so much with a Kubrick film. Even if you don't get it, or especially if you don't get it, there's still something in there that's being delivered to you that adds to the experience, that changes the experience, or completely informs the experience of what you're watching.
There's that, and very well said, by the way. More or less, you can always just, you welcome the unpredictable, and every moment you can tell has been a mind game from his very get-go.
Yep.
He's almost a borderline sociopath. He knows how to actually kind of entrap you and hold you hostage. The Shining, nowadays, everyone likes to just get into a bitch slap on book versus the movie. To hell with that. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie. It's
Well, I think that's every, okay, so the thing about it is every single piece, every single film that he's done has started from a source novel. Even 2001, it's like the companion movie to Arthur C. Clarke's book, but Kubrick wrote his own piece for that film. A Clockwork Orange is based on Anthony Burgess's novel, and no one's like, oh, the novel and the book. When we're talking about The Shining, it's such a different story, but reading The Shining, as a designer, I can so clearly pull out the inference, pull out the inspiration, pull out the core idea.
Oh yeah, it doesn't exist without the book. That is for sure. It's just these people are just going to one dimensional.
You can read the book and inside the book say, oh, I can see where Kubrick expanded on this idea and came up with this experience. It's like reading a client brief and seeing the finished project of a logo or a website and be like, oh, they wanted to communicate ABC. The design firm chose that in this way. And
right.
As a designer, that's the key to understanding Kubrick's work. Especially if you're going to be like, oh, the book is different. Well, yeah, duh. He's an artist, and he translated that information in this way to communicate what he saw.
Well, and my favorite thing of everybody, you know, just all the film guys just seem to just, you know, they can never tell you what they would have done differently. The non-constructive ones can, at least. I mean, I'm sure there are some out there, but it just gets very exhausting when it just continually just incessant. And it's like, okay, well, do you hate it or like it anymore because you know about the book versus not knowing about the book? Or
yeah, well, and it's a different story. It can never be the exact same thing because the author isn't making the film. The author isn't working on every aspect of the film. Different people are working on it, and different people have their viewpoints about it.
Correct.
And then you reading the book, you have your own viewpoint about what you are reading. So ain't nobody going to be able to translate it exactly how you, an individual, experience it, because the author is not experiencing it that way. And the author made the damn thing.
The author made the thing, maybe. And even then, you know, they can't necessarily do it any better or worse. So it's just like, you have all these other predicaments, and it's like everybody should just be happy that any of us, you know, care about, you know, wanting to see this, the fact that it's a coherent piece in and of itself. I mean, if I can understand what's going on without having to look at any other source material, then you're golden in my book. But I know other people who are like, oh, I want to do this and that. And then it's just like, does anyone want to be happy?
Well, I think a lot of it is people don't understand the level of dedication and effort it takes.
The dedication, and yep. I mean, this guy is, you know, sweating this, you know, so.
For years, I was reading that it took The Shining 5 years to be filmed. So when you are at that level, it's like, do you know what it takes to do the same project for 5 years? Mm-hmm. Do you?
Right.
And most people wouldn't. Most people get, I mean, look, we're at the end of January. Most people do their, you know, their New Year's resolutions. And by the third week in, they're like, it's too cold. It's too dark. I'll be fat, whatever. Like the level of dedication needed to do a work of art, let alone a Kubrickian work of art, is not where we're at as a
right. Yeah, how could we, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been working on a research project about The Shining for 13 years.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. to take a dose of
They Must Be Destroyed on Sight
as needed, and let the hosts Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin puff, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Hey, I heard you like movies.
I heard you like to hustle.
I heard you like podcasts.
Well, guess what?
There's a podcast for you out there called The Home Video Hustle.
Damn right.
Every Friday, we talk about whatever movie PJ picks out the bag. What does that mean? Every Wednesday on our YouTube page, I put a bunch of movies in a bag, and PJ picks one out at random. And then we just watch it. We talk about it for maybe like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever we feel like doing, wherever the conversation leads us.
But do we actually talk about the movie?
Most of the time.
Ah.
Tangents galore.
Yes.
So believe me, we may be a movie podcast, but it's not always about movies. We might talk about video games.
Mm-hmm.
Music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big one, music. Sometimes we might get a little bit of politicalness in there.
Yes.
Sometimes we may just, oh, you know what we like to do? We like to tell stories, PJ.
Ah, yes.
I am the master storyteller of the podcast realm. Undefeated. So if you like to hear about movies, video games, whatever foolishness comes to our mind, the most random stuff you could think of, check out the Home Video Hustle. You can find us on the Stitchers.
Yes.
The Google Play.
Yes.
Apple Podcasts.
What else?
Podbean.
What else?
Podcast Addict.
Goddamn.
All that. Ain't no reason you can't get your hustle on. We everywhere. Worldwide, baby.
Hustle, mother. Hustle.
Hey, we can't cuss in the promo, PJ.
Ah.
We gotta be family friendly. There may be podcasts out there that don't want his hair to say
ah.
All that good fun stuff.
Well, you.
don't run the listeners away, PJ.
Ah, I'm sorry.
But this is going kind of long.
Yes.
So we'll end this and say, hey, check out the Home Video Hustle every Friday on all the various podcast outlets. Peace.
Peace.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And while Witch didn't make it to the top of the world, he did make the Gangs of Hollywood podcast. So join the gang and enjoy a movie review podcast about movie gangs, gangsters, mobsters, and the mayhem they cause. You can find GOH Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. At GOHpod, at www.gohpod.com, as well as your favorite podcast listening app. And remember, say hello to your little friend for me.
If you take two old punk rockers who are past their prime, put them in front of a movie screen and give them a podcast, what do you get? Cinema Punks. Cinepunks. It's the mixtape of movies.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in it.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that.
Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
It's unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
popping up. Little history doll popping up at you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped from watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a
rough
movie.
How did you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach, and we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's late, it's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 bana.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes and gratuitous boobies, it's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
Welcome to Who Was She Podcast. I am your host, Tara Jabari. After a decade working in documentaries, marketing, and all things digital media, I found that podcasting is a strong medium to share stories. After years of producing for others, I decided to start my own biographical podcast. Who Was She will focus on the life of a woman throughout Baha'i history. The first season is about Lydia Zemanoff. Lydia's story explores the subjects of the power of language and faith. Her father invented the universal language Esperanto, and she came from a Jewish family and became a Baha'i. She grew up during World War I and was killed during World War II in a concentration camp, despite heroic efforts to save her life. How can one person's life intersect with so many others, connect across borders, and inspire a biography, which inspired this podcast? Over the next few weeks, I will share her story with you and the lives that were most affected by her and those who affected her life as well. They include her father, Ludwig Zemanoff, her spiritual mother, American journalist Martha Root, and the Baha'i German soldier Fritz Mako, who worked for the resistance undercover while having to serve the Nazi party. I want to thank the author Wendy Heller and George Ronald Publishing for their blessing to let me use Heller's biography, Lydia, The Life of Lydia Zemanoff, Daughter of Esperanto, as a main and instrumental resource for this podcast. So please subscribe and learn about this amazing woman who traveled through three continents in an effort to bring unity through the power of language. You can also find more information on our Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at Who Was She Podcast. Music was composed and performed by Sam Red. I am your host, Tara Jabari. Join us next time as we begin our journey about Lydia Zemanoff.
Hi, everybody. It's Mac Jackson. I wanted to invite you to a new site called the Forever Adventure Network. This website has everything. Pictures, videos, blogs. There's original music by Harmony Constant. Two podcasts. One is the MacGyver Podcast, where we celebrate Richard Dean Anderson, his iconic roles, and how it's influenced our lives. There's episode discussions, interviews, and life conversations. The second podcast is the Never Gets Old Podcast, where we celebrate all the best things that we love in life, from TV, movies, music, and comics. The site is also the home for the MacGyver SG-1 audio series. An ongoing adventure series that continues the adventures of MacGyver and SG-1. There are also multiple stores to choose from for all of your pop culture and adventure needs. Come on by and check us out today. And thanks for joining the adventure.
Are you sick of the same old stale podcasts? Well, then join Vanessa and Darren as they dissect movies of all kinds. The two lifelong cinema lovers bring their favorites, curiosities, and first-time watches to the operating table and inject them with a healthy dose of snark. Then there's the waiting room, where they examine books and short stories. So just look for them on Apple Podcasts and where fine podcasts are available. They're part of the Legion Podcast Network. Follow them on Twitter at VD Clinic Pod. Join them on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/VD Clinic Pod. Or email them at vdclinicpod@gmail.com. They're ready to cure what ails you. And still, they just might be a little contagious.
We now continue with our program.
When you're watching, like, and I don't want to insult another director, but let's say M. Night Shyamalan or someone who wants to have the level of thought and, you know, execution that Kubrick has, but just doesn't. It's easy to say, this is what happens in the plot. This person talks to this other person. Here's what they say.
Right. I watched Twilight Zone nonstop. This is what I meant. This is what I did a twist on.
Now, here's the truth. There is, you talk about Twilight Zone. That's my favorite show in the entire universe of existence. And there are baby symbols like a Kubrick film, but not to the level that people spend their whole doctoral thesis writing about it.
Right.
When it comes to Kubrick films, there is a level of intention that straddles the dialogue, the people as archetypal people, and not like, oh, this is my, like, not real people.
Very true.
They become symbol people. And that's how you have to sit. You have to sit on top of the Kubrick film and then see the ingredients he's presenting them to, see the order in which you are receiving it, and then say, this is how he's using it. There is a reason. Like, in The Shining, you don't see Wendy and Jack happy in their marriage.
Never.
Never. You never hear, oh, hi, babe. How's it going, babe? You don't hear that. What you hear is, here's dinner, hon, or here's breakfast. How about you take me for a walk? And he's like, can't, gotta work. That's the nicest they ever are.
Right.
And then you just see the relationship degrade. You're never given this at one time was a happy marriage. Now, if you compare it to, and I would say an equatable horror film, the 1979 Amityville Horror. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah. A perfect counterpart.
Yep. Because I've been doing this project for 13 years, sir.
The Haunting, all those kinds of movies.
Specifically in Amityville Horror, because it's like the haunted house, the guy before killed his family because of the haunting. He's not able to sleep, he's not able to work, and he turns on his family. That is the bare bones similarities between The Shining and Amityville Horror. The difference is, there's two differences. One, they have a happy marriage. So when the guy starts being a shitty person, the wife is like, hey, dude, you're being shitty. In The Shining, she's never like, you don't call me that. You don't say, are you fucking crazy? This is not you. That is him. And in the end of the Amityville Horror,
it's the only version of him he knows.
Yep. And that's the thing that people don't pay attention to. that subtle thing, or like how Danny is never smiling or happy. He's a very sullen 5-year-old.
And, you know, even with how every house, you know, since the book and the movie have had to feature a Native American spiritual ground, you already know, even before they admit that part, you know, the way he's acting, you know, he's happy, but he doesn't seem naturally happy. It's like, okay, I don't know. They haven't even told him he's sold the house to him yet. He's just acting very weird, you know, like he's off his rocker.
The awareness there comes into play when Wendy and Jack fight. And that, for me, The Shining is so clearly a story. It works on a micro-macro level. The micro level is domestic violence.
That's a very good point. And I don't think I've ever, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think I've ever seen anyone really go into it.
Because the macro level is American culture as the patriarchal domestic violence masculine energy against the Americans, African Americans, women and children.
Right. And who are the victims? An African-American friend, children, the wife. And like you say, everyone is so focused on just him losing it and which part of the place is real or in his head. And it's just like they...
And as we sit in 2021, after angry white people stormed the Capitol...
I know. It's like... It's
very challenging. But they did it because they lost. They had the temper tantrum because they lost. So much of the information within The Shining is Jack's mediocrity, his inability to face that, his unwillingness to say being a father and a husband is actually okay work. There is this entire shift between what he is paid to do and what he actually spends his time doing, and how that's Wendy's fault.
So true.
We don't talk about it, and it's like, okay, so we're just gonna ignore the giant
in a way. He's basically an anti Me Too guy. He is every Me Too person's he is every lifetime husband's, you know, the worst nightmare in any of these. Is like, he is the guy who, again, in his mind, it's not just that he bought a house. It's that he's lived an accomplished life. We never even see him a single day at work, but we can assume that, you know, he's saved up.
He didn't buy that house. Is this what you think? He got a job as a janitor over the winter.
Or did he?
That's the thing. When a caretaker is a euphemistic, nicer phrase for a janitor.
Yeah, I mean... In his mind, he's basically the owner, if you think.
In his mind, he's very important. He's very important. He's always been there. His drinks are paid for free. Grady, the man who succeeded in what he cannot do, tells Jack how important he is. Everything is ego.
It's impossible to take it all in one scoop. That is the beauty of many of these movies.
And that is true.
And so anyone who said, I got it all, no, bullshit. you read...
I have been working on this project. I'm obviously not every day in 2020, from 2008 to 2019, and I still get stuff.
Nice.
I still get stuff where I'm like, "Oh, that is the same." And now it's like very, very nuanced, subtle art study, right? Like the way that Kubrick. Uh-huh. creates his compositions is similar to Renaissance paintings. Yeah, it's for real. There's a level of...
And there's plenty of portraits in that movie, so...
Man. Well, and I just mean like the way he plans his compositions. So there will be the same color across the whole composition that forms a triangle.
Yeah.
Now, as a creator... There are things you do intentionally. There are things you do subconsciously because it feels good to you.
Right.
And though that they happen. So that's part of the project where it's like, yes, it's not him being this maniacal genius. He has a plan. This is his message making system. And it happens across the visuals. It happens across the structure. It happens across the dialogue. It happens and it repeats in series of threes.
The closest you might get is maybe, say, a giallo type movie. Or particular Dario Argento. But see, the other problem is with those, in making this comparison as a contrast, half the time that shit isn't even meant to be figured out. While with this, you are supposed to peel it like an orange, layer by layer, like an onion.
I feel like with David Lynch,
Lynch is a good counterpart. You can never figure him out.
But he says you can, and so
really?
I would. Okay. Yes, his films make complete sense, and I'm like, to you surrealist mastermind, to you.
Yeah, I like Lost Highway, but I haven't figured it out yet, so I mean,
well, here's the thing. Shit. With David Lynch, his message making comes from inside. He has a very, he loves transcendental meditation, he really does love surrealism, and so with those two things, they are an internal message making system that do make sense if you can ground it. And like Rosetta Stone translation, right? Like, that's how I live. With Kubrick, he's an external person. The research and the documents and the card catalogs of movies he never even made, all of that can absolutely be tracked and matched. So my theory about it is, this is a man who thinks through photography and communicates visually, but is obsessed with chess and therefore can plan and think strategically.
Right. And don't get me wrong, regardless of whether you like or hate his movies, you never once think that he's just making this up off the top of his head.
Really? You think that people don't watch 2001? Or I think people watch A Clockwork Orange and feel betrayed.
Oh, I'm sure they do. I mean, there's going to be people who, because they react to everything with either their fists or just their internal anger, that there's going to be people who have already closed them out before they've even gotten to the first hour, you know, so.
Or that they cannot imagine someone having this level of depth in their communication.
Right. How dare you outsmart me? I hate you. I hate you. You
know, and not even that aware of it. Just, I don't understand it. Therefore, I reject it.
I don't understand it. Therefore, I am jealous. See, with Dogma 95 style stuff, I just think it's a gimmick that you either buy into. There's been some good ones, and there's been some ones like Lars von Trier. I cannot.
I do not like Lars von Trier whatsoever.
Okay, so you're on the same bandwagon as me, where, you know, peeling them apart, you know.
I don't need that misogyny or anti-Semitism in my life.
Well, he to me is like either one of Paul Verhoeven's Dutch jokes that hasn't translated well, or he's like Nicholas Winding Refn, where it's just one twist, one too many, but really there isn't any twist. It's like, I'm already beside myself when I'm in a movie and there's already, you know, what feels like padding, or you're just playing with my head just to waste my time. Yeah. Instead of, there is a beginning, middle, and end. It's like with Lynch, you know, he intended that way. So just stop ripping him off. And like you say, here with Kubrick, he's had to not only outline it, paint it, and then, you know, dress it up some more, and then add all these other material, which is why he's gotten this, the genius label. But he's also, much like a painting, you'll find a little element here and there, a photobomb, something, and it is meant to be figured out. And I'm sure there's plenty of secrets he took to his grave even. And that's his right, because at least we figured out a good quarter of them, you know? So don't just, I would get in arguments with films people all the time. It's like, okay, I thought you were all about, you know, this is a betrayal of this and that narrative. It meant nothing before. And yet you're defending, you know, all these other controversial movies, which totally betray their entire premise of everything that came before meant nothing. So, like you say, it is, what would you say is his most subjective work by far?
I mean, 2001 okay. is designed to be understood completely by the subconscious.
It's basically what dreams are made of.
Oh, and when you get to that level, what we're talking about is semiotics, which is how I found the commonality between design and Kubrick's filmmaking.
Really?
Because communicating through imagery, one, is really hard. Two, it changes you completely. So for me, it's very much like this. But in terms of things that would make other people feel upset, I don't know. Maybe A Clockwork Orange or Lolita. There is a message there. With A Clockwork Orange, there is like, I don't know what the message is. What do you think the message is? Which is a violent, strange film to have a neutral stance on, but that's the point.
There's that. Then it had a sequel, which was like, okay, what's the point of even continuing it? The story's already concluded, you know?
What sequel, Lolita?
No, 2001.
Oh, I don't even...
2010.
I don't count that. The year.
Okay, all good.
Because that's not... I mean, and that's the thing, like, what I'm focusing on is his viewpoint and his message making.
Right.
So if he's not involved, it's like, yeah, and that's really how I feel.
you weren't that far back. I thought maybe 5 seconds about after watching a 2-hour movie. So, long story short, yeah, I really don't know where I feel about Lolita. I should watch it again, but in this day and age, you know,
it's challenging. And I am a part of this Kubrick group on Facebook. And in that space, I observe a lot.
In this day and age, you might as well be inside the mind of a QAnon person.
Please.
I just am talking about just the, you know, secret pedophile who doesn't realize he's a pedophile.
The thing that fascinates me is not that it's the secret pedophile or that there's the back and forth between the two masculine characters. It's how the mom character and how the older women in the film are treated, therefore behave. And that's
very true, because the
don't talk about that. And it's like, how can you miss this glaring chunk of information completely influences? Because like the end of the film, Lolita is pregnant and married.
In all fairness, I think it's just because we're distracted by all the other shit hitting the fan.
That to me is a big diarrhea plop getting ready to drop.
You're right. I think it's just because everyone's gotten, you know, literally just their cranium just slammed.
Well, it's also a very masculine. Kubrick films, I feel like, have been co-opted by bro culture. And it is, you know, he's a masculine director, but he's not a misogynist. And that's the thing. Like, don't look at what the females are doing.
That's true. I never once feel like he is an actual, you know, incel or, you know, misogynist.
Like Lars von Trier. Lars von Trier is a...
Lars is definitely a loser who is
anti-Christ.
You're right. And Melancholia, he has been in front of the TV way too long to where I don't think he even knows what's real anymore. So, breaking the waves, don't get me started. Anyway, like you say, and I think the problem, you know, going back to Lolita, that's another one. Is like they even tried remaking it and see.
You can't. The message that Kubrick had with it is probably not in the Nabokov story. I mean, obviously there are elements, there have to be, but like the amount of sexuality, the amount of and not obviously between Humbert and Lolita and Quilty and Lolita and the wife's sexual frustration and the swinging couple and like all of it compounded. And then it's like, if you'd like to pick apart String, please, there's a whole pile of other String that very much adds into what this is about.
Right.
And, you know, to prepare for this, I was like, let me revisit these things because I really want to speak about them. And I watched Lolita before I started my project and rewatched it this weekend. And when the mom is hugging the dead husband's ashes, and she's like, I was so young, you then see what happened to Lolita happened to the mom too.
Yeah.
Your youth is lost. You get married. You have a child. You resent your child when they come into their youth. Like, just layers and layers of what society is like in the 60s. Now, it's not as like, is this serious? Because if you watch Rosemary's Baby, holy banana boats. Like, Rosemary's Baby is so obviously patriarchal that it's like, is this a comedy? Is she supposed to be a child? No, that's just what life was like then. And so looking back from our time where women get to have agency and a sense of self, it's different. It's different. And I know a couple of women who talk about film, but it is mostly a male space. And if it's mostly a male space, these things are not going to be noticed, let alone talked about.
And that's just it. I mean, those are definitely movies that could have only been made in the 60s, because if you made it now, you would have basically half a movie. You would have like either a good idea but bad execution, or you would have good execution but incomprehensible to, like, you know, today's audience. And so like you say, it is very much, you know, in and of the realm of, you know, just conquering every realm of every person's awareness, what they actually know is a problem in society, whether or not they even want to address it. And more often than not, you know, all these movies, nothing gets fully addressed, because that is also ironically real life. Nothing gets fully figured out because, you know,
there's too much.
People don't know how to organize or even take responsibility. They're like, I'll start the show, but I'm not, you know, like, it's kind of like today's world, where it's like, you know, I'm a fed, I'll take you to trial, but only if I get a career promotion. You know, everybody's interested in their self-worth, or there's got to be just some other compromise, which pretty much takes away the whole point of doing it to begin with. You know, there is always, and like with this, you know, you get to, as a voyeur, kind of see it from all afar and just be like, wow, I'm so, you know, I kind of want to, I'm so glad I'm not part of this problem, but yet I want to know more about this problem, which I'm not even a part of. And
I think that's the awareness that everybody's like, I want to raise awareness for this issue.
Awareness. Yes. Perfect.
And that's the feeling that you're describing. It's the doorway to empathy.
But instead of just seeing a massacre or even watching a PSA that replays, you know, like you say, it's just, you are in the moment and you are.
Well, there's the trap again, except this one is positive because it's not a PSA and therefore you don't feel heavy handed and you don't feel,
Right.
Right. But
I'm waiting for the Sarah McLachlan music to play.
And that's really, people don't like that because it really makes you feel bad. And so when you do it in the guise of a film, it begins what we were talking about in the beginning, where it's like you feel disappointed and maybe you wasted your time. But at the end of the day, there is a seed planted that is going to help you with being more aware, if only because it introduced you to things that you would never think about or recognize.
Right. Even going into The Shining, we can't possibly recognize all the things that are happening because they haven't happened to.
But it would actually be part of how it works, in my opinion. Like the fact is, my dog upsetting. Can you hear my dog?
Barely.
Okay.
Good. Thank you for asking. Okay.
It is lined up like an abuse. If The Shining is a micro and macro of domestic abuse, then the fact that there is too much happening, the fact that there are those weird disconnects. Oh, I don't get her because she's irritating me.
That's a good point. It takes you a moment.
I am so sorry.
All good. But no, that's a good point. When anyone inflicts abusers don't necessarily know that they're being abusive, and like you say, you know, the abused, it takes you a moment to realize, oh, you know,
if it even happens,
stop it.
And the thing about it is, like, I think going through 2020, and the lockdowns and the quarantine, but then also having the news cycle be so hectic and relentless, really reiterated to me why Kubrick did the pacing in his film, why
he was being driven insane post-World War II.
And you cannot think about the thing that just happened because, oh my fucking God, there are skeletons in the couch. Like, there's so many things that happen in quick succession that you are forced to forget because the brain only has a limited amount of bandwidth and you are watching the film.
Oh, yeah. And you got to fight your own war now, which is how do I survive?
The experience is meant to mimic the abuse, and the experience is meant to mimic the gaslighting of being a minority under the threat of an angry white person.
A minority, there's even, if you want to even go there, there's even, I mean, now we're kind of in a society not too far from even Get Out, where we have to figure out who is our true friend. I've already cut off like 5 other friends or other people who I haven't even heard from, and I don't care if I ever hear from them again, because I know not only where they stand mentally, politically, physically, I also just know that they've always been thinking this whole whatever the cost, you know, if I show a bigoted side, if I show a, you know, tough love side, you know, that's okay. You know, I've been, and nothing I can do about it. They've only been thinking that way for about 20 to 40 years, depending on these people. And like you say, I have no business wasting my time with them because, you know, much like what, you know, you or I believe what the right thing to do is and what's acceptable, that's all ingrained. That's not going away. Even though we like to think of ourselves more open-minded, we also, you know, it would take us a while for us to even become, you know, cold-blooded or do something violent to defend a bunch of other people. You know, we're not in that mindset. So at the same time, I mean, this is about, Kubrick is very much just, you basically get a sense that he only survived as long as he did just through film. I never heard much about him being in person or social encounter. He probably didn't like much of the real world. He's like, I hate it. I want to build a new movie world where I can embrace my own kind of hell.
What I think, I mean, I never met him. It was very much this is what it's like. Oh, I don't need that. And then you translate that experience and your feelings through your art. And for him, it was photography until he realized he could make more money with film, and then it became film.
That's basically it.
It's true. No, it's totally true. He was like, oh, I could make more money if I became a filmmaker. Guess I'm making that now. And that's what I did. But like, if you watch A Clockwork Orange, and my husband hates this movie. He hates it. And he did 2 tours in Iraq, and he just cannot handle the upsetting nature of the film. And I'm like, sweetheart, if you sit above it in the observational lens, it's easier. It's easier. And so we're watching it, and he's like, I definitely feel better observing it and not acting like this is a movie I'm supposed to watch. But that's what Kubrick talks about. He talks about how both sides of the political spectrum manipulate the other, manipulate the center for their own gain. It talks about fascism. It talks about the family structure as a sort of unit that keeps you grounded. It talks about religion. And is religion helpful, or is religion a force of control? It talks about high culture and low culture. And it's just inundated.
It's a dystopian thing, you know, years before we see other movies.
At the same time, there's, okay, so he's walking in a record store, and it's very, very vibrant, and it's very, very modern, but he's wearing a Victorian coat. And you're like, that's a cool choice. There's no other part of him or no other scene with Alex that has him wearing Victorian clothing.
He's sort of old school and he's...
High culture, low culture. The Victorian culture was all about those who have money and status and then the rest of the people who would pay like a nickel to get drunk on a piece of string because they couldn't afford a hotel.
Right. Like, your uncool thing is my cool thing. That's my bread and butter.
Yeah. And at the end where he's like being manipulated by the interior, the Ministry of the Interior, what is he witnessing? He's witnessing himself have sex with a woman while people in Victorian clothing clap.
He rejects reality and substitutes his own.
Yeah. And it's who is supporting him? The higher culture, the higher status.
He has the high ground.
The crappy place he lives. And that's not something that gets talked about in A Clockwork Orange because you have like a violent fight, a rape, and then another rape in the first 8 minutes.
Maybe those are the same people seen at the hotel in The Shining.
Oh, please. See, I have a theory.
I couldn't resist. That just popped up.
No, I have this theory that Eyes Wide Shut is actually Kubrick telling the story of the people in the black and white photos from The Shining.
Oh, there you go. It's a trilogy.
I do, and I feel like that's why...
Because none of the other ones have any of these other themes. Not even Lolita or any of the other ones. No, not even.
They totally do. I feel like Lolita gets...
Really? All right.
Well, okay. So
I think that was his starting ground, and then he embraced how he was going to confront social norms and sexuality.
I feel like it's difficult because in the 60s, it was very, very censored. And there was a lot of frustration about that. And I don't think he would have agreed to make the film had he known the level of censorship and control that he would be under. But
I think he secretly knew. I agree. Yes. He didn't want any obstacles.
The arrogance of like, what do you mean it's actually going to be this hard?
Kind of. Right. To him, filmmaking is easy. Just do endless takes and... Get it done.
Yourself and write it yourself and just make people like he breaks people like he treats actors like I treat my fonts where it's like you do what I want you to do except my fonts don't have feelings and it's a lot nicer.
Exactly.
But yeah, his films, the themes are sex and violence, and in A Clockwork Orange it's sex as violence and violence as sex. But in the Shining, there's this recent theory, and I could not talk to it, but it's about how it's actually Wendy who's insane.
Oh, for God's sakes.
Imagine being so blind to misogyny that you're like, this abused woman who's crying and can't leave her abusive husband. And it's like, yes, she is insane because abuse drives you insane, but it's not that.
We call this... alternative facts.
Oh, that classic phrase. Mm. Yeah, it's just interesting to me. It's real interesting. And then Eyes Wide Shut, Nicole Kidman gets so much shit. It's so fascinating where it's like you're really hating on Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise is, okay, no, that's cool.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Where
photography in Eyes Wide Shut, it's insane.
I think the other issue is because that's a Christmas movie, it adds a little more bit of dread to it. It's like, damn, that's a pretty sad Christmas.
And, and Christmas is practically a character in that movie because of all of the lights. I mean, it's one of those films where for me, when I watch it, I'm like, I get it. There is intention here. I get it. What are you saying to me? I understand that you're trying to say something. Are you just 80? Like, what is actually happening here? That's how I feel with Eyes Wide Shut, where certain moments are so clear And then other moments are so obfuscated.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me really want to dive in. But then that's the truth with Kubrick's films. It's like, oh, God, yeah, what's this mean? What's this about? Well, like in Clockwork Orange, why is the mother so much older than her husband? Biologically, she would not be able to have children. She is not the mother, but that's, we don't, that's not something people have observed, and it drives me crazy.
I think you pretty much have nailed them on the head. So, I mean, how would you rank some of these movies? I'm not saying you got to rank all of them. I mean, because...
How could you rank your favorite cats? I cannot rank them.
I'm definitely closer to Past the Glory and The Shining, just because those are just the most surprising. I don't get anything out of Barry Lyndon. I know many do. But...
Oh, my God. Okay. I had to see Barry Lyndon in the theater in order to stay awake while watching it. And
3 hours.
It's clear I'm like interested in Kubrick's films.
It's like he made it saying, see, I can do what you don't expect me to do. You expecting a shocking movie? No, it's not shocking at all.
Well, okay. So I think he works in pairs. And if 2001 is a painting that moves, which I feel like it is, it's like a painting in the MoMA, Barry Lyndon is an oil painting that moves, that would be in like the Victoria and Albert Hall Museum. Uh-huh. Like, beautiful, absolutely beautiful, technologically impressive.
I'm not saying he can't.
Fucking boring, so boring. And it's like, why is this the story that you pull? Why did you go from A Clockwork Orange to Barry Lyndon? And who would even make that journey is my question. That would be what I asked him. Be like, what? And then to go from The Shining. What?
Jesus.
I like random, okay? Like
I feel like it was...
Jesus. Yeah.
It's like he decided... I mean, maybe it was a mercenary job. Do this movie, you get to do whatever crazy thing you do next.
It was such a flop. It was such a flop that he like hid. He hid and then came out with The Shining. So I feel like The Shining is probably his most accessible. I think it's still in our cultural mind as clear. I mean, it is so in our pop culture, and the movie came out 40 years ago. What other movie that came out 40 years ago are you like, oh yeah, I could totally drop a meme about this with Bernie in the background?
Lawrence of Arabia. But I know what you mean.
It's very, very seldom that a movie can age that well.
Right. And
I feel like let's see, The Shining. Eyes Wide Shut pairs with it pretty well. It's about a family that has some issues, and the man has a lot of ambition and wants to strive beyond his ambition and realizes, I actually have a hot wife who wants to have sex with me. I should be more grateful.
Right.
With A Clockwork Orange, oh God, it's very challenging to watch that film. It asks a lot of you. And it frustrates me that people like to dress up as those characters and use the language. And it's like, did we watch the same film? Were we on that one together? But Paths of Glory, Dr. Strangelove, movies that came before 2001 are beautiful in terms of their composition, but they don't have the messaging depth that happened after 2001. So the shots in the Paths of Glory are beautiful. And they can work as photographs, same as Lolita. But the shots in The Shining, while beautiful, have a lot of messaging. In the styling, in the way that the character is costumed, in the posing, in the background posing, and the set, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much more meat with the pretty.
Right.
And that's where I spend my time. I spend them post 2001. Yeah.
Okay. No, perfect. Because, I mean, he was just always evolving. I mean, you could maybe say he was Hitchcock before Hitchcock realized he was Hitchcock. You know, he was just that kind of... I'm sure he even surprised himself after a while. I was like, oh, I just thought of that. I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah.
And he'd take it to his grave before he admitted it, but I mean.
Or not, you know, and who, that's the thing. There's such a air of mystery around him of like this untouchable genius. And I don't know if that's true as much as a disinterest in talking about that and engaging himself in that space and just, this is how I see, this is what I want to make, and that's enough for me.
Right. For sure. Other than that, where can we find you on the web?
Purifantastico.com is my business, where I take all of this and use it for clients who are not Kubrick. But I bring all of that depth. So purefantastico.com, Instagram at purefantastico, and Facebook at purefantastico.
For sure. Nice. And we'd like to have you back. Just say the word for just any other filmmaker who you just know is like, or actor who you just feel you just want to tackle again soon. Go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Philip, I mean, it broke my heart when Philip Seymour Hoffman passed away.
Yeah.
Selfishly, I was not done watching his work.
Well, that was definitely another example of someone who, you know, he was such a good actor and we never knew a single thing about his inner troubles. Yeah. So I think that's why it was a double-edged sword. It was like, okay, well, you know, usually, you know, when someone passes away, you know, it's a shitstorm in the media or there's just something else. You got the sense it's like, hey, I think someone's dying of cancer. I haven't heard much from lately, you know, something like that. And it's like, here, we didn't get shit. It just came out of stage right. And we're like, whoa.
Well, I think my husband laughs, but I wish he would have gone the way of Robert Downey Jr., who had a lot of drug problems earlier, but was able to bounce back and reconnect with himself and has found a lot more success that you wouldn't even think of his past. Like watching the Simpsons episodes where they make fun of Robert Downey Jr.
Right. It's almost like the same person, you know?
Right? Like it's almost irrelevant.
It's not like Charlie Sheen where it didn't matter whether he was playing Charlie Sheen or playing a character. It followed him like, you know, giant shadow. And like you say, there's all these other actors where it's like, you can try all you want. We're not trying to be negative or everything, but, you know, they can put on the best makeup. You can be doing a voice that's still, you know,
Law sounds like, I mean, even when he's acting and like not reading from a script, sounds like I can see the words scrolling as he's doing his role. There's just flatness.
There's definitely actors like that where it's like, I hear you in the voice booth, good or bad. You know, they hired you because of your name. And this is where it becomes very annoying, especially for all the other struggling people in this industry where it's like, okay, I gave it 100% and the other person gave it hardly a thing and they got the role. I hate your guts, you know? So it does become that kind of thing. I feel like Kubrick basically exited stage right because, you know, he had had it with all this jealousy. Now, realistically, I know that's not the reason, but I'm just saying he is fortunate. He even lived in what got to live in his own viewpoints when he did, where he did, how he did, because so many other people are struggling to even just figure out not only it used to be, what will I do a decade from now? Now it's, I don't even know what I'm going to do next year. I got this, I got that. But expected to change, you know, expected to cripple it before the year has even begun or ended, you know. So I think what mankind can learn from these movies as a whole is that you not only choose your own life, but you also might end up digging your own grave, because you got to realize that any decision you make can backfire, and any kind of hell that you're in right now might not be as bad as whatever other kind of hell you were initially heading for, you know?
Honestly, that's Full Metal Jacket. Like, that is the sentence of Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
But with his work, it's like, find the thing you love and let it kill you.
Perfect. Yeah. And love it to death before it loves you to death and cripples you with its love.
Yes.
This has been a very cerebral thing. Suck it, Wachowskis. love you guys, but, and gals, but...
Ladies,
but so other than that, thank you ever so much for joining in this brigade. This was a battle worth fighting.
Oh, I'm so glad you had me. This is the first time I got to be on a podcast talking about this.
Absolutely. And I hope some of our friends, like the Psychosemantics podcast and other people who can listen to this and be like, damn, mind blown. And Godspeed to you.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a-